This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of March 29th, 2020. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 127. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. The Is It Just Me commentary. The big deal feature. Canada stands up to the IOC and the IOC listens. Tokyo 2020 is postponed to 2021 because of the COVID-19 pandemic. What does this mean for the world's biggest political, economic, and sporting spectacle? I check in with author and professor Jules Boykoff. And I ask the top doctor at Vancouver Coastal Health, how many Vancouverites are suffering coronavirus and how many are in hospital? You'll want to hear the answer. Plus, I'll award a virtual Nanaimo bar to someone making a difference. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or was that a surreal sitting of the British Columbia Legislature on March 23rd? A quorum of a dozen MLAs came together for the emergency afternoon sitting to pass a supply bill and a job protection bill. Except for polite applause, there was none of the usual desk thumping and jeering across the aisle. It was somber and businesslike, and they all respected social distancing. West End NDP MLA Spencer Chandra Herbert served as speaker because Darrell Plekis was observing the 14-day self-isolation order after returning from a personal trip to England to visit his son at university. Premier John Horgan set the tone for the afternoon.
And when we think, honourable members, of what our lives were like 6 weeks ago, it's hard to imagine how far we have come as a society, how far we have come as a community, as we've tried to grapple with a pandemic that is gripping not just British Columbia, not just Canada, not just North America, but indeed the world. And it's humbling to think that the 12 of us here today, representing different political perspectives from around British Columbia, have arrived today to do something that I can't recall in my time as a member of this place, coming on 15 years, nor as a student of history, going back over the many, many decades, century and a half of Canada's existence, where British Columbians have had their elected representatives meet on such a dark and troubling occasion to talk about how we come out of that darkness better off for the effort, better off because of the cooperation, better off because of the spirit that I believe is in all of us as British Columbians and Canadians, focused on helping each other, being kind, and being mindful that our actions are important. I want to thank the Leader of the Opposition, the Opposition House Leader, members of the Green Party, members of the Liberal Party, who have been overwhelmingly supportive of initiatives that we've brought forward, briefings that are unusual in any normal legislative session, to have members from both sides of the House talking and working on solutions, taking advantage of the experience in the opposition benches. Many, many cabinet ministers who understand the challenges, the administrative challenges of running a department in normal circumstances, fully understanding how running those departments in extraordinary circumstance requires criticism, to be sure, if we misstep, but criticism that's focused on better outcomes always. And the absence of partisanship, I think all British Columbians should celebrate. At this unique time, partisanship has left the building. People are here to work together with one singular focus. That's the health and well-being of all British Columbians.
Later, Lieutenant Governor Janet Austin arrived to give royal assent to the two bills.
Your Honor, Lieutenant Governor.
Employment Standards Amendment Act No. 2, 2020. In Her Majesty's name, Her Honor the Lieutenant Governor doth assent to this act. Supply Act No. 2, 2020. In Her Majesty's name, Her Honour the Lieutenant Governor doth thank Her Majesty's loyal subjects, accepts their benevolence, and assents to this act.
Truly heartfelt appreciation to all of you for the outstanding job that you're doing in a cross-partisan way. It's wonderful to see the kind of teamwork that we have in our province among our political leaders. And I have to tell you honestly, I've heard from friends and colleagues across the country who are so impressed with BC's leadership and BC's the collaboration and the teamwork that we see happening here. I'll also share that I heard this afternoon from Admiral Ochterlony, and I told him I was coming here, and he said, well, if you have a chance, would you please tell them all how much I appreciate what they're doing and what an outstanding job they're doing. So I want you all to stay safe, wash your hands, and because we need you here in British Columbia. Thank you so much. Hi, Chika.
Harried, Government House Leader.
Thank you, Honourable Speaker. I wish everyone a safe travel home. Wash your hands, maintain social distance. And with that, I move the House to now adjourn.
Thank you, House Leader. You've heard the question, members. All those in favour say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Thank you, members. This House now stands adjourned until further notice. Be safe, be well.
As Horgan said, partisanship has left the building, all right. It'll be back someday. Not a matter of if, but when. And British Columbians do long for life to return to normal. What do you think? Email bob@thebreaker.news. Wuhan Coronavirus Pandemic 2020. Now it's time on the Breaker.news podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. Danny Mok in the South China Morning Post. Two arrested for allegedly stealing rice from Aeon Supermarket in Hong Kong amid shortage fears due to pandemic. Police stopped the pair from Nepal and Bangladesh outside Aeon Supermarket in Hong Kong on Friday and found six packs of rice totaling 12 kilograms on them. On Tuesday, a security guard chased a man after seeing him stealing three packs of rice, weighing 15 kilograms in total, from the same store. The cases came to light as many Hong Kongers thronged supermarkets to stock up on rice amid worries that Vietnamese authorities might ban rice exports to ensure domestic food security. Kyoto News Service in the Japan Times. Infected Japanese who allegedly caused flight delay at Narita arrested. A man was arrested March 27th in Chiba Prefecture on suspicion of business obstruction after allegedly delaying a flight at Narita Airport just before takeoff the previous day by telling the crew he had the novel coronavirus. The 69-year-old is suspected of telling the cabin crew that he was infected with a deadly virus. It is unknown whether he is really infected. The man denied making such a statement. He is a resident of a town in Ehime Prefecture. You can't make this up. The town is called Toon. He lives in Toontown. Kelly Lazaro and Emma Nobel of ABC News Australia. Coronavirus panic buying no issue for Victorian family toilet paper free for 5 years. Meg Ullman and Patrick Jones from Dalesford now use a squat composting toilet and family cloths, reusable wipes made from flannel. They made the change when they realized the popular toilet paper delivery service they used manufactured their rolls in China. After each wipe, the cloth is put into a bucket beside the toilet with optional eucalyptus oil. And every 5 days to a week, the family cloth takes a spin in a front loader washing machine at maximum heat. After being washed, the family cloth is dried on an outdoors clothes horse. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.news podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.news podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. Ron Judd in the Seattle Times, ER doctor who criticized Bellingham Hospital's coronavirus protections, has been fired. Ming Lin worked at Peace Health St. Joseph Medical Center for 17 years and pleaded for more safety equipment. The whistleblower was fired March 27th. Lin said supervisors threatened his employment more than a week ago after he spoke to reporters and made social media posts accusing Peace Health of a lack of urgency to protect healthcare workers from the virus. Peace Health St. Joseph is the only emergency facility for some 250,000 people in the state's northwest corner. Maxine Bernstein in the Oregonian. Feds seize 100 fraudulent COVID-19 test kits shipped from China, addressed to Portland man with prior ties to cannabis industry. The man who ordered the package of kits at 50 cents each is a former senior vice president of a now-defunct Portland cannabis oil company, said the affidavit for a search warrant signed by a judge on March 25th. The invoice revealed the package came from a China-based company called Anhui Deep Blue Medical Technology Company. The man hasn't been arrested. His name was redacted from the affidavit. He had previously worked at Cure Cannabis Solutions. The only way now to get a test for the new coronavirus is through a healthcare provider. There is no authorized home test kit. Julian Kolsut of Czech News. BC looking at potential release of some nonviolent sentenced offenders due to COVID-19. The Ministry of Public Safety and Solicitor General says BC Corrections is currently conducting a risk assessment for consideration for early release. They add the determination for potential release includes whether the individual released would have the necessary supports in place, whether family, community, or on reserve, given 30% of BC's inmate population is Indigenous. The push for the release is due to the fact that at the federal and provincial correctional facilities, social distancing to avoid COVID-19 is nearly impossible. And these headlines in the Breaker.News this week. BC's new car dealers credit lobbying after winning the government's essential service nod. BC's two biggest cities, Vancouver and Surrey, kept in the dark about coronavirus patient stats. Doug McCallum's hiring freeze and the coronavirus emergency leave Surrey a lot less safe, says Firefighters Union President. Read the stories behind these headlines. Go to thebreaker.news.
So I wish people would stop thinking about whether or not there's a positive case in their community and understand the message that we need to assume that COVID-19 is circulating in all communities at this time.
That is the voice of Vancouver Coastal Health Chief Medical Officer Dr. Patricia Daly. At the March 19th Emergency City Council meeting, Richmond Medical Officer Dr. Mina Dewar told city councillors that there were 8 cases of coronavirus in their jurisdiction. So if there were 8 in Richmond, how many could there be in Vancouver? And what about Surrey? How many people have been hospitalized with coronavirus in the province's 2 biggest cities? On March 26th, I asked Dr. Daly those questions. But the answers are provincial government secrets.
We are no longer providing details about number of positive cases because as we've changed our testing strategy, those numbers are less meaningful. We did identify to some communities early on that we had identified cases, but now with our changing testing, because we are not testing most people who may have COVID-19, including returning travelers who get sick, people with mild disease in the community, we are not, those numbers have become meaningless. Every day, Dr. Bonnie Henry will release the total number of laboratory confirmed cases, but she will always emphasize that this does not reflect the total number of cases in the community, and she'll release the number of hospitalized cases.
Vancouver and Surrey have a combined population of 1.2 million people, but are part of the larger Vancouver Coastal and Fraser Health regions. The two health authorities cover an area that stretches from the Sunshine Coast to Hope. It's home to 60% of British Columbia's 5.1 million people. Meanwhile, on March 25th, the World Health Organization Director General, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, urgently called on countries that have introduced so-called lockdown measures, such as Canada, to follow 6 key actions. 2 of them are about finding suspected cases of coronavirus and testing for them.
We call on all countries who have introduced so-called lockdown measures to use this time to attack the virus. You have created a second window of opportunity. The question is, how will you use it? Implement a system to find every suspected case at community level. Ramp up production capacity and availability of testing.
Dr. Daly from Vancouver Coastal Health said BC is taking a different route.
The message from the World Health Organization around testing is primarily so that we can identify where the virus is spreading in communities. The strategy that we have in place in BC, first of all, we've had access to testing here ahead of many other jurisdictions, including the United States, that allowed us, for example, to identify returning travelers, isolate them, and prevent spread early on. But now that we know the virus is circulating in the community, there is no need to test everybody who might have mild disease. In fact, doing so may put others at risk. We right now have every returning traveler self-isolating at home for that 2-week period. If they get symptoms and they go out to a test site, they may expose other people who are not infected to the virus, and it won't change the recommended management for those cases. So the strategy we have taken is to say that if you have mild disease, stay home. Don't go out, even to seek testing, if it's not needed, and you will not expose others. Of course, for anyone who comes to our hospitals with more severe disease, we will do testing. We will test to identify outbreaks, and we will test healthcare workers who provide care to vulnerable people. That is what we call a smart testing strategy. You are not required to identify every case to control the spread of this. And I would point out that even in China, where they identified over 80,000 cases, we know there were many, many, many more cases of milder disease that were never identified, and yet they were able to bring down the curve of that outbreak. You don't need to identify every case to take measures to prevent the spread of the virus.
The last word goes to a doctor on the front line who is blowing the whistle on BC's lack of testing for coronavirus. On March 28th, Dr. Sean Wurmsbecker posted a video to YouTube describing his frustration. Wurmsbecker is an emergency room physician, and he wishes he could do more for patients that he sees at Royal Columbian Hospital in New Westminster. This is what Dr. Wurmsbecker had to say.
So, I just finished my shift. Overall, today wasn't bad. We didn't see huge volumes overall in the department, but today really for me hammered home one of the frustrations that we're seeing as frontline providers. And that's the fact that based on our current resources, we are very much under testing the population. You know, I see a lot of discussions online with regards to the total number of positive cases as being somehow a benchmark for how we're doing or how we're not doing, and people are modifying their behavior accordingly. But the reality is, currently, I'm only able to swab patients who are either ill enough to come into hospital, healthcare workers, or clusters that are being actively investigated under the guideline of the MHO. So what that means is if I see you in my department and you are clinically stable, your lungs are functioning normally, I'm going to be sending you home and directing you to self-quarantine for 14 days. And that scares me because, I mean, 10 years of clinical practice have taught me that, unfortunately, patients aren't consistent in following direction. You know, often what's heard, no matter how we say it, is that if we're not testing you, we're not really taking you seriously. And that's not the case. But it means that we're going to be really, you know, lowballing the actual numbers. And I saw several cases today that I have no doubt are positive cases. So it's important that the public knows this. It's also important that the public understands why this is the case. It's not for a lack of wanting to test. It's the reality that it is still more important that we test those patients that we admit. Because if I am putting multiple patients on a single unit, realistically, we can't keep them perfectly isolated from one another. And so if I have one patient who has COVID and they're roomed with someone who's critically ill who doesn't, then that's going to compromise that other patient's health. So we need to be able to obviously identify those more so than those who are well enough to go home. But it still means that we're unfortunately not performing to the kind of standards that were met at other countries that have been able to effectively flatten their curve, so to speak. So we can't use those countries like Singapore or Korea as a benchmark for what we can expect to come. If anything, I think we have to unfortunately look more to the countries that haven't done as well, because we simply aren't at that standard of quarantine, we're not at that standard of social isolation, and we're definitely not at that standard of testing. In the meantime, we just have to try to do our best with the people we see.
The pandemic has ground Canada's economy to a halt. British Columbia is under a provincial state of emergency, and the NDP minority government passed a $5 billion aid package on March 23rd. The federal government has agreed to a $107 billion aid package in order to soften the blow of a sudden recession caused by draconian disease control measures inspired by China, where the virus originated, in Wuhan City last November. As of March 28th, British Columbia reported 884 cases of coronavirus and 17 deaths. Almost 400 people have recovered. Finally, on March 24th, some common sense. The International Olympic Committee and the Tokyo 2020 Olympic Organizing Committee agreed to postpone the Games until 2021, just a few days after planning to study postponement for another month. Here is International Olympic Committee President Thomas Bach.
There, the World Health Organization speaks of the acceleration of the spreading of the virus. So we were addressing this situation and came to the conclusion that in order to safeguard the health of the athletes and everybody involved in the Olympic Games that we have to postpone.
Yoshiro Mori, the head of the organizing committee and a former prime minister of Japan, made the announcement through a translator.
We hope that the Games will stay in Japan as the beacon of hope for the world.
Canada played a key role. It sent a public signal that it could not wait another month for a decision. The time was now to boycott Tokyo 2020 for health reasons. With typical Canadian modesty, Canadian Olympic Committee President Tricia Smith reflected on the bold move.
You know that this decision was made, it was a very difficult decision, and it was made really domestically. We had to make this decision for the safety of our athletes and to contribute our part to controlling this virus. I do think it is a factor and one of the many factors that had to be taken into account when the further decisions were being made. And we provided additional information to the IOC on how exactly this was affecting our athletes, how exactly we came to the determination that it was not safe to continue in this present situation, and that we had to make this decision. So I think the information that we provided to them likely would have helped in the decision.
This week's guest is Jules Boykoff, who joins me from Portland, Oregon. Jules is a political science professor at Portland University and author of several books about the politics and economics of the Olympics. The latest is No Olympians, Inside the Fight Against Capitalist Mega Sports in Los Angeles, Tokyo, and Beyond. I started by asking Jules why it took so long for the IOC to make this decision.
Well, like many people who follow the Olympics, I was alarmed by the slowness of the International Olympic Committee to act. After all, other major sports events and leagues were being canceled left and right. The International Olympic Committee's president, Thomas Bach, admitted that he was slow to act in part because he was listening to people like U.S. President Donald Trump, who was saying that things might be back to normal by mid-April, even though all epidemiological experts refuted such a rosy outlook. So that Bach would listen to Trump rather than experts from the World Health Organization or other medical bodies should be alarming to anybody who cares about athletes and the Olympics, let alone wider public health. So postponement is a tricky business. I argued in an essay last week for the New York Times that cancellation was the more prudent path. You're already hearing from people inside of Tokyo, those involved with the Tokyo 2020 experience, a guy like the CEO, Toshiro Muto, who said recently that additional costs would be, quote, massive. And, you know, we know who's going to pay those massive costs. It's the Japanese taxpayers. Right now they're saying it'll be an additional $2.7 billion to make the Olympics happen around a year from now. But they have a pretty shady track record in the sense that the original bid was $7.3 billion, and it exploded to somewhere in the neighborhood of $26 to $28 billion, if you believe an official audit from the Japanese government. So a lot going on in this situation, but costs are definitely going to expand because of the postponement.
Now, the Canadian Olympic Committee played a key role last Sunday in going public and saying that they were essentially going to boycott. They were not going to go to an Olympics in 2020 in Tokyo. They would only go if there is Olympics in 2021. There were other sports associations and federations that were speaking out, but really Canada was the leader in this, the first national Olympic association to step forward and say, no, this can't go forward.
Yeah, kudos to Canada, and then following them, Australia, Germany, Portugal. Postponement would have never happened were it not for the bold leadership of first individual athletes and then National Olympic and Paralympic committees like Canada. So while the IOC and Tokyo organizers dithered, promising that the Games needed to go on, athletes stepped up into this leadership vacuum and they demanded that the Games be postponed. You know, I'm here in Oregon speaking to you where Olympic legends come from. You know, Ashton Eaton, he was saying the Games should be postponed. Dick Fosbury of the Fosbury Flop, he was saying the game should be postponed. Everybody, it seemed, was weighing in. Those were truly concerned with athletes. And the fact that it took the IOC so long was really alarming to athletes. And I just say one other thing about this. You know, I was really interested to see once the International Olympic Committee did decide to postpone what their priorities were going forward. If they actually cared about athletes, and they use that phrase athletes first, But if they actually cared about athletes, one might think that one of the first things that the International Olympic Committee would say would be, we're going to supply additional mental health support for athletes around the globe that are now dealing with this difficult situation. Instead, before that, Thomas Bach was talking about how the athletes just sort of needed to keep training, keep your eye on the Olympic prize, when many of them were like, where and how? I mean, him talking to USA Safe in the United States, where our Olympic training centers have been closed. So you tell athletes from the U.S. to keep training, where? Where are they supposed to do this? So, again, just a total botched job by the International Olympic Committee. And thank goodness that Canada and other countries stood up, and athletes, individual athletes around the world, because that was the catalyst for actually postponing these Olympics.
Our guest this week on the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast is Jules Boykoff, political science professor and author in Portland, Oregon. When the Great Recession hit in 2008, it suddenly became harder for Vancouver 2010 Winter Olympics organizers. Sponsors had to make major cutbacks to advertising and tickets, and some, like General Motors and Nortel, went into bankruptcy. Tokyo 2020 official sponsors and broadcasters are suddenly facing a grim economic outlook, which translates to potential losses for the IOC in Tokyo 2020. So delaying the games by a year makes some economic sense.
Oh, you're absolutely correct, Bob, that money had a lot to do with the way this all transpired. It's funny, though, when you hear the IOC president, Thomas Bach, speaking from the podium, he tries to make it seem like economic considerations had absolutely nothing to do with it. It was always about athlete health the entire way. That just doesn't ring true on any level, because you know as well as anybody that it's those economic relationships that the IOC holds with the broadcasters, like in my country, NBC, but also with those corporate sponsors. That's where more than 90% of the International Olympic Committee's revenue comes from. And so to just say, oh, that doesn't really matter, that stuff, I mean, everybody knows that's fantasy talk. And there's going to be discussions of money moving forward. As I say, the current estimation is going to be $2.7 billion extra moving forward. Who's going to pay for that? It looks like it'll be Japanese taxpayers, as I've said. But will the IOC step up? One final thought on this is the federations that you mentioned, those international sports federations, many of them are completely reliant. They're on the International Olympic Committee and thus totally subservient to their demands. And so I think that also played a role here, that these international federations derive their money for operations on the International Olympic Committee, who in turn banks on the Olympics happening. And that's why you didn't see a cancellation. And that's why you did see so many yes men and yes women from these different federations just going with whatever Thomas Bach said about the way that things needed to be with the games.
Now, NBC and the European broadcasters have the greatest influence on the schedule. It's very likely that they'll try to make this in late July 2021 to conform to as closely as possible to the schedule that they had for 2020, just because the fall sports TV schedule just gets very busy with other rights, the National Football League, NCAA football, Major League Baseball, and European soccer. So we're likely to see it at that time of the year again in 2021, a time of the year where a lot of athletes were saying, why are you holding it this time of year for athlete safety? If it really is athletes first, that's a very hot time of the year in Japan. And that's not when the athlete's going to be at the best. That's when athletes might even be vulnerable to the conditions.
Yeah, that point has been lost in the mix here as the discussion of postponement has unfolded. I was in Tokyo and Fukushima last summer in July and August, right at the time when the Olympics were supposed to start this year. And I'm telling you, it was hot, and it dangerously hot. They were doing little things to try to control it by having fountains out, spraying water out on people just walking down the street. But you're right, to perform in that kind of temperature was going to be incredibly difficult. And it points to the fact that the calendar decision was made not based on athlete health or the spectator comfort, but rather with that little window, that sweet spot for broadcasters in the summer when the calendar's a little bit more dry. And so there have been a little bit of discussion from Thomas Bach to try to hold a spring Olympics. I bet that's going to go nowhere. I think what you're suggesting is absolutely correct, that they're going to aim for that exact same moment 1 year later and see if they can't fill the schedule. But even that comes with some complications, in the sense that the World Track Championship set for Eugene, just an hour and 45 minutes by car south of where I am, was supposed to be at that same time. So they're going to have to ask Eugene to figure out a different time to hold those track championships. So it looks like they're willing to go along, but there's going to be a lot of shifting around the schedule to make way for the Olympics if they are to happen next summer.
And then there's the other interesting dynamic, which is if it is held in late July, early August of 2021, that will leave a very little turnaround time to the next Olympics, the Winter Olympics, Beijing 2022, which are February of 2022. And there's a lot of controversy on the horizon there, simply because Beijing is different from what it was in 2008. It's now under Xi Jinping's rule, and they have a million, maybe millions of people incarcerated in Xinjiang province simply because they're Muslim. And there have been whispers of boycott campaigns. At least the human rights organizations will have a lot to talk about on the way to Beijing 2022.
Absolutely. There's so much that's going to be fought over Beijing 2022, including this destruction of a natural habitat to make way for the Olympic ski run there. And it's interesting, if you go back to 2001, when Beijing was first bidding on the 2008 Summer Olympics, we were told by members of the Beijing bid committee that if they were granted the Olympics, that would have a positive effect on human rights in the country and civil liberties. Well, nothing of the sort has happened. In fact, Human Rights Watch official Sophie Richardson, she said that the Olympics in 2008 were in fact a catalyst for further human rights abuses in the country. And what you're talking about with the ethnic Uyghurs, what's happening now, them getting sent to so-called re-education camps, is just an extension of the terrible track record that Beijing has on human rights. And I think that this points up the hypocrisy, really, from the International Olympic Committee, where they have a great talking point of the Olympics being all about humanitarian goals and so on, whereas in reality, they're willing to look the other way when there's cities like Beijing and countries like China that are willing to fork over big bucks to keep the Olympics flowing. And so, again, I think this points to a major problem with leadership within the International Olympic Committee, and it has to be put on the shoulders of the man at the top, Thomas Bach.
And in the last year, China has also hosted other mega events. They had the World Police and Fire Games in Chengdu. They had the World Military Games in Wuhan. Wuhan, of course, where the coronavirus originated. And on the way to 2022, these questions will only be amplified. What do you think of the long-term future of the Olympic movement? There always has been talk that it's just become way too big, way too controversial, too political. It's strayed so far beyond the goals of showcasing athletic excellence and bringing the world together. Do you think that the Olympic movement is at a turning point? Because after Beijing, then we've got Paris 2024, we've got Milan, Italy 2026 winter, and then, of course, Los Angeles.
The International Olympic Committee has long been in a sort of slow-motion crisis. They already faced a situation at least a couple of years ago where fewer and fewer cities are eager to host the Olympics, and that's why we saw their unusual move back in 2017 when the IOC simultaneously assigned the 2024 Olympics to Paris and 2028 to Los Angeles, as you said. That was kind of a Hail Mary move, in a sense, because those are the only two cities left bidding on the 2024 Olympics. You see a lot of interest, especially from countries in the global south that the IOC has been cultivating, say from India, for example, that might well put bids for future Olympic Games. But this is the way it kind of always happens. A lot of cities say, yeah, we're sort of interested in the Olympics at these early bid stages. But over time, especially when people are afforded an opportunity to actually weigh in via ballot measure or public referendum, that interest tends to dry up, at least among the general public. Of course, the elites who are pushing to bid in each city, and you know this well from Vancouver, they're going to remain interested no matter what. But I think the tide has really turned, especially, I would say, since Vancouver hosted the Olympics in 2010. And I think the people in Vancouver, critical journalists, activists, academics, human rights workers, really deserve a lot of the credit for sort of bringing us around the corner and lifting up a lot of the reasons why we should be skeptical of the Olympics. I view Vancouver as a pivot point. And the way that we talk about the Olympics today is so incredibly different than it was even 15 years ago, with so much more critical thinking going into the discussion. And this has made it more difficult for the International Olympic Committee to figure out who's going to host. But, you know, the Olympics are basically like sort of a car when the check engine light goes on, and the International Olympic Committee has basically sort of said, you know, we're just going to take a piece of black tape and put it over the check engine light, not actually deal with the issues that are internal to the engine. And someday that's going to come around to haunt them. Hopefully that day comes a little bit sooner than later, so we have a little bit more justice in this world.
And finally, to come full circle, the reason why we're talking to you, Jules, is because, of course, Tokyo 2020 is being postponed because of the coronavirus pandemic. What is it like on the ground in Portland at this time with the public health emergency in your neighborhood, in your city?
Yeah, I mean, well, first, I think it's really strange that the International Olympic Committee is insisting that even though the Olympics are going to take place now in 2021, that we're still supposed to call them the Tokyo 2020 Olympics. It's this sort of strange mix of arrogance and magical thinking. It's sort of their war is peace, freedom is slavery moment. But here in Portland, you know, we're basically in lockdown. If you're not providing essential services, you are supposed to stay in your home by the governor's order. It's actually a misdemeanor if you're caught out just kind of out having fun or breaking the social distancing rules in public. And so we're finally taking it very seriously. This is an obviously unprecedented, serious situation. And I'm glad to say that here in Portland, we are taking it as such.
That was Jules Boykoff, professor of political science at Portland University. He joined me from Portland, Oregon. The virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to a person or group that is making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to Vancouver's Tricia Smith, the president of the Canadian Olympic Committee. It took guts for the COC and its Team Canada partners in the Canadian Paralympic Committee to be the first in the world to publicly boycott Tokyo 2020 because of the COVID-19 pandemic. It worked because the IOC and Japan agreed to postpone the Games to 2021. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of March 29th, 2020. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on March 29th in 1962, Billy Beane was born in Orlando? A major leaguer with four teams in 5 years, he became the general manager of the Oakland A's for 18 years and revolutionized baseball with data analytics. Brad Pitt starred as Beane in the 2011 film adaptation of the book Moneyball. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit TheBreaker.News on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/TheBreakerNews. PATREON.com/TheBreakerNews. Until next week.